Evolutionary Psychology, Part 1, The Science of Human Nature, Lecture 2, Investigating the Unmentionable.
In the first lecture in this series, we briefly reviewed the history of psychology. Now, we're almost ready to begin our investigation of evolutionary psychology itself. All that remains before we can do that is a brief and surprisingly tactless consideration of our subject matter, ourselves. And there lies a serious problem, one that has plagued anyone who has attempted to investigate what we humans do and why we do it. The problem, of course, is this. We don't necessarily want to know what we're actually doing or why we're doing it, and we certainly don't want other people to figure it out. Yes, I know. I started the first lecture in this series by claiming that we are voyeurs, endlessly fascinated with other people's behavior and with our own. So how can I square that assertion with the one that I've just made, that evolutionary psychology bothers a lot of people because it provides an almost voyeuristic view of ourselves? I think the answer is that we want to know what other people are doing and why they're doing it. But in general, we don't want them to know what we're doing, and heaven forbid why we're doing it. As we will see in more detail later, being able to intuit the contents of other people's minds is an ability that confers extraordinary adaptive value. Our minds contain what has been called an agency detector. Indeed, we even know what part of the brain is specialized for such detection. This agency detector can infer the intentions of others based on a comparison between their behavior and ours, and then infer their motivations, again, by comparison with ours, so that we can anticipate their actions in the future. What are agents, anyway? Agents are any entity that can act intentionally, that is, with a plan about what to do in the future. We plan what to do all the time, and we infer the intentions of other intentional agents. Intentionality and the ability to detect it has extraordinarily adaptive value. It requires in us the capacity to infer intentions, which is sometimes referred to as a theory of mind. This ability has extraordinary adaptive value in both competitive and cooperative settings. In competitive settings, if we can accurately anticipate our opponent's next moves, we can modify our behavior in such a way as to counter them, and if the circumstances are right, defend against them or even defeat them. In cooperative settings, being able to accurately determine if a potential partner is genuinely cooperating or is actually a cheater can help us avoid expending energy and resources without any positive outcome. And of course, this double-edged sword cuts both ways. If we can confuse our opponents by masking our behaviors and intentions, we may gain a significant advantage over them, especially if we can accurately judge their intentions and motivations. And if we can take advantage of our partners without being perceived as having done so, we can benefit to a degree even greater than if we simply cooperate without such guile. Social behavior, in other words, and the underlying cognitive processes that motivate it and guide it, is at the same time a potential gold mine and a minefield in which those individuals with the greatest skill at inferring the intentions of others and masking their own, or disclosing them voluntarily if doing so is advantageous, are usually the winners. And so, talking about all of this makes people uncomfortable and strikes them as tactless or even tacky. Indeed, one of the social skills we all have to master if we are to become fully functional adults is to learn when it is polite to talk about such things and when it isn't. Our parents, other adults, our peers, our teachers, and sometimes, well, if they're particularly precocious, even our children, generally do not hesitate to point out what subjects are off limits for conversation in polite social situations. We are especially cautioned not to discuss certain subjects over dinner, and most especially if there are guests present, as to do so would be to commit a serious social faux pas. And what might those unmentionable subjects be? Why, exactly those subjects that are the focus of the science of evolutionary psychology: politics, sex, religion, and violence. And, one even worse and more embarrassing to ourselves and to others, the actual unvarnished contents of our own private minds. What makes all this so difficult for us as children, and even for some adults, those who are socially clueless, is that we must also learn that exactly the same list of impolite subjects is not only appropriate as topics of conversation under certain circumstances, but that to withhold our own opinions and examples of them would be considered to be almost a betrayal. I'm speaking, of course, of gossip. What anthropologist and evolutionary psychologist Robin Dunbar has proposed as the glue that binds human societies together. One of the things that distinguishes children from adults is the obsession that the latter have with gossip. Indeed, one of the events that marks coming of age in adult society is when we're finally mature enough to be allowed to sit in on the gossip, which in most societies happens when we're doing those mundane activities that make social life possible: preparing or cleaning up after a meal, going to get or coming home with food, and so forth. Furthermore, the topics most often discussed in gossip are precisely the same topics that are not to be discussed in polite company: politics, sex, religion, and violence. Indeed, it appears that polite conversation and gossip are two sides of the same coin and are both essential to the smooth functioning of society. Is there an evolutionary explanation for why this is the case? Dunbar has proposed that gossip plays the same role in human sociality that grooming plays in other primates. Primates, and especially our closest relatives, the apes, spend significant portions of their lives grooming each other, sitting around quietly, combing through each other's hair, and picking things from it: bits of litter, dead skin, and ectoparasites such as lice, fleas, and ticks. While the removal of ectoparasites has been postulated as a fitness-enhancing activity, especially if such parasites cause disease, there is little evidence that this is actually the case. In particular, even in the absence of ectoparasites, as in zoos, for example, where such parasites are chemically eliminated, social grooming continues to occupy over 40% of the waking day of a typical great ape. Primatologists have proposed that social grooming helps to forge closer social bonds between members of primate groups, an idea that can be explicitly tied to a theory of the evolution of cooperation. Essentially, social grooming is a form of daily reciprocal altruism. Literally, "I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine," that reinforces the tendency for members of a social group to perform altruistic acts towards each other, that is, to cooperate. This would explain why such grooming continues without any real objects being removed from the fur or skin of those being groomed. Social grooming is also part of the process by which dominance hierarchies are established and maintained in primate social groups. Time and motion budgets have been calculated that show that the amount and intensity of grooming is directly related to position in primate dominance hierarchies, with more dominant individuals being groomed more often than lower-ranking individuals. Furthermore, new relationships are formed by the initiation of social grooming, and existing relationships can be strengthened or weakened by increasing or decreasing the intensity of social grooming. Dunbar has proposed that language, and especially gossip, evolved essentially as a substitute for social grooming in our human ancestors. Again, time and energy budgets indicate that humans spend roughly equivalent amounts of time gossiping, that is, conducting informal social conversations, that other apes spend in social grooming. According to Dunbar's hypothesis, gossip among humans has very similar functions to social grooming in apes, especially in forming and strengthening bonds of reciprocal altruism, that is, cooperation, between social group members. However, I don't think this is the whole story. One problem with Dunbar's hypothesis is that it doesn't explain the apparent similarity between what can't be discussed in polite conversation, but is the subject of most gossip. While it may be true that gossip does play a role in humans that is similar to the role played by social grooming in apes, including sorting out dominance hierarchies, I believe that it also plays an important role in allowing individuals to ascertain which behaviors are allowable and which are not, and most importantly, which individuals are reliable and which are not, and if one is a cheater, which individuals might make easy marks and who might not. Indeed, cheating of all kinds, including cheating in representing one's role in a social group, is one of the principal topics of gossip, perhaps more than any other. Reciprocal altruism, the basis of cooperation in many societies, requires that cheaters be identified and punished, or at least avoided. An effective way to do this is via gossip, in which people trade stories about the behavior and inferred motivations of other group members. Along the way, people subtly, and sometimes not so subtly, also indicate their own opinions and therefore their underlying motivations relative to the behaviors and motivations of the individuals being gossiped about, usually in a way that presents them in as positive a light as possible to other group members. Gossip, in other words, functions as a continuing report on experiments in progress, which group members use to adjust their own behavior and interpret the behavior of other group members in such a way as to maintain an efficient blend of individual and group benefit. Throughout the rest of the lectures in this series, we will be considering in unabashed detail precisely those behaviors and inferred motivations that are not appropriate subjects in polite company, but about which we gossip all the time. Furthermore, we shall be doing so for essentially the same reasons that people gossip: to determine what people's actual behaviors and motivations are, rather than what they say or even think they are. And, just as in the case of gossip, we shall be doing so in such a way as to use the information we have gained to determine what the fitness consequences of the revealed behaviors and motivations might be. The main difference is, when we try to ascertain what people are actually doing, as opposed to what they or others say they are doing, and use that information to infer an explanation as to why they are doing it, we will not, in most cases, pronounce judgments on those whose behaviors and motivations we have examined. There are two reasons why we'll refrain from this. As I emphasized in the first lecture, science isn't about how things ought to be, and even less about how we'd like things to be, but about how things are. Science, in other words, is about description, not prescription. We will also repeatedly see ourselves in the situations, behaviors, and motivations that we will investigate. And this alone should be both humbling and exhilarating, humbling because we will realize that under the skin we're all just a bunch of oversized apes trying to make a living in a difficult world. And exhilarating because when one realizes that one's behavior is, in effect, neither perverse nor unusual, and can understand why we do what we do, we can simultaneously stop beating ourselves up for some of the things that we do, and begin to do something different, even something better, both for ourselves and for society. Oddly enough, science itself, and especially evolutionary psychology, shares a surprising number of characteristics with gossip. As I have already mentioned, it looks unabashed upon those behaviors not talked about in polite society. Things like copulating surreptitiously with multiple mates, injuring and killing people for personal gain, rape, murder, incest, theft, indeed, the whole list of deadly sins, pride, envy, anger, greed, gluttony, sloth, and lust. We will not revel in these things, nor will we use science to somehow excuse them. Indeed, we will neither praise nor blame any of them. Instead, we will use a scientific perspective to try to explain how and why we do them. Or, at least, why we're tempted to do them. After all, it wouldn't be necessary to call them sins and prohibit them if we weren't sorely tempted to commit them from time to time. And we won't always be focusing on sins. Humility, admiration, calm, generosity, temperance, industry, and most of all love will also make their appearance, and their adaptive value will be considered. In both the examination of sins and virtues, we will use an armamentarium of techniques to figure out exactly what it is that people are in fact doing, and use the insights we have gained from evolutionary theory to try to figure out why they are doing it. So, how will we go about this? How do evolutionary psychologists study human behavior and motivation? Well, here's a short list, including many of the general techniques that evolutionary psychologists use to study and understand human behavior. As we tick them off, try to think about human behavior, and even your own behavior and motivations, the way an animal behaviorist thinks about, well, about animal behavior. In this endeavor, it might help to keep in mind four questions. What is the immediate cause of the behavior? How does the behavior develop, and what role does learning play in its development? What is the evolutionarily adaptive function of the behavior? And what behaviors in our ancestors might it have descended from, and how? Ready? Here we go. There are a number of methods that evolutionary psychologists use to study human nature. The first is, of course, simple observations. By unobtrusively observing people in their natural habitats, it may be possible to determine what their natural, that is, their evolved, behaviors are. There are a surprising number of studies in evolutionary psychology in which the researcher simply watched what people were doing as unobtrusively as possible. A classic example is a series of motion pictures of human facial expressions filmed by Ehrenhaus Ivel Ibisfeld, a student of Konrad Lorenz, and a self-described human ethologist. Using a specially constructed camera, Ivel Ibisfeld was able to film people around the world behaving naturally, that is, without knowing they were being filmed. We will see some of the surprising things he discovered when we consider one of the most ancient and ubiquitous of human behaviors, flirting. Controlled experiments. By manipulating the conditions in which particular behaviors occur, it may be possible to determine what the causes, contexts, and underlying biology of what such behaviors are, and how they relate to evolution by natural selection. There are numerous examples of this in later lectures, so for now, let's just say that this technique doesn't necessarily involve a formal laboratory per se. However, The basic principle of experimental science is the same. A specific variable is manipulated in a controlled way to determine how the manipulation of the variable affects the behavior under study, if indeed it affects it at all. For example, in a study of the effects of general excitement on attraction, men were approached by a female confederate in two different locations, on a rickety bridge over a gorge and on a low bridge made out of concrete, and later asked to rate the attractiveness of the female. Men who met the woman on the rickety bridge consistently rated her as more attractive, despite the fact that the same woman in the same clothing asking the same questions appeared in both locations. Natural experiments. By finding situations in which conditions correlated with particular behaviors occur without direct intervention by the investigator, it may be possible to determine what the causes, contexts, and underlying biology of such behaviors are, and how they relate to evolution by natural selection without directly or intentionally manipulating the situation. This technique is especially useful in situations in which the variable under investigation can't be manipulated without committing some extreme ethical violation. For example, we shall see that polygamy is a subject that evolutionary psychologists have studied in detail. While most people in most societies might not necessarily find polygamy ethically justifiable today, and probably would not encourage deliberate experiments into polygamy or similar behaviors, it is still possible to study polygamy in humans by studying people who have had more than one sexual partner during their lifetimes, and especially those who have had children with more than one person, to attempt to correlate the observed patterns of behavior with particular contexts to see if there are evolutionary implications of polygamy in humans, which, indeed, as we will see, there are. Comparisons between species. Similar behaviors can evolve as the result of similar ecological circumstances, especially among closer related species. We have already discussed one of the guiding principles behind such investigations, the idea that similar causes often result in similar effects. As we will see, this makes careful study of other primates, especially great apes, very valuable in understanding some of the evolutionary roots of human behavior. We will also see, perhaps surprisingly, that the same can be said about studying the behavior of some of the social carnivores, especially African lions and spotted hyenas, as their behavioral ecology is similar to that of our Pleistocene ancestors. Comparisons within species. Similar behaviors can provide evidence for descent from common ancestors, while differences can elucidate the effects of differing environments. Here we will find a powerful tool for analyzing human behavior and its evolutionary implications, as different environments are often correlated with different patterns of behavior. Comparisons between males and females. Again, as we will see, differences between male and female behavior can reveal differences in sexual selection between the genders. As both classical evolutionary theory and sexual selection theory predict, specialization in sex roles is an extremely common adaptive pattern in many species of animals. Although the subject is currently politically controversial, we will see clear examples of differences between females and males in both behavior and motivation. Differences that can be correlated with different selective pressures, especially during courtship and mating. Comparisons between individuals. Differences between individuals can reveal the effects of differing environments, while similarities can provide information about the limits of adaptation. Again, this is an extremely powerful technique to elucidate the behavioral ecology of specific human behaviors. As just one example, we will see how differences in economic, legal, and social systems are correlated with strikingly different mating patterns in humans. Patterns that can be explained by differences in sexual selection in different social contexts. We will also see that contrary to the assertions of many social scientists, human behavior is not infinitely malleable, nor explainable in purely cultural terms. There are consistent patterns and limitations in human behavior across the species, patterns that once again make the most sense when considered in the light of evolution by natural and sexual selection. Comparisons between the same individual in different contexts. Such differences can highlight the effects of environmental context on the development of behaviors and the expression of the underlying motivations that cause it and shape its development. Such comparisons amount to controlled natural experiments in which the behavior of individuals in one context serves as a control against which to compare their behaviors in other contexts. Both similarities and differences in responses to different situations provide information that can be correlated with natural selection to yield evolutionary hypotheses about the origins and dimensions of such behavior patterns. Comparisons between the same individual at different times. Differences can highlight the effects of development, maturation, and personal history. Here we are asking a question about how individuals change during their lifetimes, and as we will see, the answers can provide many clues to the evolutionary history of the behaviors and their motivations. Once again, courtship and mating provide an example. As we will see, young men court women in very different ways and with very different degrees of success than older men. Differences that can be correlated with sexual selection in both females and males against a background of ecological and economic factors. And finally, demographic analyses. Since natural selection is essentially a demographic process, data derived from demographic analyses, such as census data, can yield useful clues in the analysis of human behavioral evolution. Although such data may have been collected for very different reasons, with evolutionary theory as a guide, it is often possible to tease relevant patterns out of such data, patterns that have clear evolutionary implications. As we will see, re-examination of some widely available demographic data can provide surprising conclusions, especially when viewed from an evolutionary viewpoint. Once again, courtship and mating patterns, as reflected in marriage and divorce statistics, provide an excellent example. As a result of such demographic analysis, it is reasonable to assert that the overwhelming majority of Americans are polygamous, not monogamous. And this is true for humans in virtually all cultures. So, we have most of our tools in hand, and it's almost time to start looking at some actual human behaviors from the viewpoint of an evolutionary psychologist. Before we do that, though, I'd like to take a more detailed look at the theory of evolution by natural selection and how natural selection produces evolutionary adaptations. In the next lecture, we will learn about Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection as he presented it in The Origin of Species. We will learn the prerequisites that Darwin suggested were necessary for evolution to occur. And we will see how those prerequisites produce natural selection and adaptations as a virtually inevitable outcome of natural processes. We will also see how evolutionary adaptations, those things that are the result of natural selection, seem to exist for a purpose. But we will also see that this seeming appearance of purposefulness is probably an illusion. Evolution by natural selection produces things that seem to have a purpose, what we call adaptations. But the process of natural selection itself doesn't need to have any purpose at all. That'll be what we look at in the next lecture.
This ends Lecture 2. If you borrowed this course from a public library and would like your own copy of the course guide for future reference, call Recorded Books at 1-800-636-3399 and we'll send you a free copy. A shipping charge will apply.